put aside the environmental and the social imperatives of improved sustainability, the economic imperative is so clear now, right? And I think staring down the barrel at us is a massive opportunity within the real estate space to be part of the change and to benefit and profit from the change.
You're listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for real estate industry sales professionals, property managers, and leaders. With thanks to our partner, Connect Now, Elevate brings you the best tools, thinking, and strategies to elevate your results. For more information about how Connect Now can make moving easier for your clients, visit connectnow.com.au. And to get new episodes of Elevate directly to your inbox, sign up at eliteagent.com/subscribe. Here is your host, Samantha McLean.
Hey, hey everyone, it's Sam here. Today we're joined by Jacob Kane, the current president of the Real Estate Institute of Victoria. Jake's been instrumental in shaping policies and advocating for ethical standards within the real estate industry for quite some time now. But before stepping into his role at REIV, he's pursued a diverse career that's included music, business, and international relations. He's currently undertaking a PhD at ANU's National Security College, focusing on the term cyber attack. And he recently represented the industry at COP29, where he explored innovative sustainability practices that can be integrated into real estate. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Jacob Kane.
Thanks, Sam. It's absolutely my pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah. Actually, it's my pleasure too. And just fun fact, reading all those things that you've done and looking at your bio and things like that, you know, we used to say that Johnny Fung at Domain was like the most qualified person we'd ever had on a podcast. Don't tell him, but I think you're up there.
Oh, well, thank you. That's in esteemed company. I'm a big fan of John and what he does for you at Domain and for the industry as well. So in rarefied air. It's an interesting background, isn't it? It's diverse. I probably could be accused of not being able to sit still. That's kind of something I like to keep busy. And within my own real estate company, I suppose I've gotten myself to a position where you've got a great team around me. They effectively run the business without too much input from me. So that leaves me with a fair amount of spare time. And I suppose that's where a lot of those other interests and involvements have stemmed from.
Yeah, well, I'd love to delve into some of those today, but I guess for anyone who doesn't know you that well, tell us a little bit about your journey into the real estate industry and a little bit about how it's led you to your current role in being president of the REIV.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in a former life, as you referenced earlier on, I was actually a professional operatic tenor. I worked with a number of the companies across the country and a little bit internationally as well. And I loved opera and I loved performing. But unfortunately, it was an industry very much in decline, facing sort of an existential crisis. It continues to this day. I've been retired for about 13 years now, but I made the call sort of when my career was starting to sort of hit its straps, because I could see that despite the fact that I was pretty well employed, particularly compared to a lot of other singers around the country, I was doing, you know, really well. I was really not so financially stable at the same time. There was lots of periods of unemployment. There was lots of uncertainty. My wife, who was also an opera singer, we just had our first child and we were sort of staring at the prospect of a lot of touring, a lot of being away from home. And that sort of forced my hand to make a call to step into real estate. And there was an opportunity there because my dad ran a real estate agency. So that's how I got into real estate. I started at the bottom, you know, I was reception, property manager, sales assistant, database manager. I've done everything there is in a real estate business over the past sort of 15 years. And I suppose from the time I got into real estate, being second generation, I'd seen my dad working really hard for decade after decade, you know, 7 day weeks, toiling away and often not really getting the kind of respect that I felt he deserved. Despite all the hard work, he was often kind of considered a bit dodgy for being in the real estate sector, just by proximity to having to the industry. And that was something that I sort of brought a chip on my shoulder into the industry saying, you know, how do we overcome this? Because I know so many people that work in the space, in the sector, who are the hardest working, the most professional, the most ethical, the most disciplined, the most supportive of their clients and customers. And I came in, I suppose, with a bit of a burning passion to address that. Part of what I saw as the perception issue related to the educational standards within the industry. But beyond that, also some of the practices that had become not necessarily endemic, but had become widespread and were having an impact in terms of the reputation of the professionals within the space. So I got involved with the Real Estate Institute really early. You know, I was on the Young Agents chapter, and then I served as the chair of the Melbourne division, got an opportunity to represent the Real Estate Institute on the board of Real Estate View, now View Media Group. And then eventually, yeah, was elected to the board of about 5 years ago.
Yeah, amazing. And I guess let's sort of start with Victoria now and then we can kind of branch out. But over the last year, what are some of the most significant trends that you've noticed in the Victorian real estate market?
Yeah, well, I've been trying to keep positive across the past 12 months because I don't think it helps us to dwell on the negative aspects of the context that we find ourselves in. But the unavoidable reality of the situation is that the market in Victoria has been relatively subdued from the perspective of the selling. Prices have been stagnant and in recent quarters have started to decline. Now, in terms of that, when we look at the medians and we look at the underlying data, the reality is that Victoria has done a little bit better than some of the other states in introducing supply into the market, right? So an inevitable reality of greater supply is a downturn in terms of prices, right? Like that's an inescapable truth, which I don't think a lot of people have really reconciled in their head. Everyone's calling for more supply, better housing affordability, but not really contemplating that that translates into lower property prices. The context from a rental perspective, obviously a lot of people around the country are talking about the legislative and taxation environment that we have in Victoria. It has become more onerous than other states and it has become more regulated. Now, some of these regulations are fantastic and they're great for sort of equalizing the platform and creating a better rental experience for renters in Victoria. There's absolutely no argument around that. Some of them have served to disincentivize rental providers, as we call them here in Victoria, landlords as they're called everywhere else in the state, and property investors. These regulations and taxes have served to really disincentivize people from entering the market and staying in that market. And as a result, we've seen a significant exodus of landlords out of the system, which we always talk about this at the Real Estate Institute. The downstream effects of that are that renting conditions have never been tougher for Victorian renters. The rental conditions within a property are better, but the access and affordability of properties has never been worse.
It's hard, you know, isn't it, where you sort of turn a lever and I guess interest rates is another lever that we kind of turn in the economy. You turn it one way because you think it's going to help one thing and then all of a sudden all of these other issues, the devil always in the detail, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why it's so critical whenever I use the term tinkering, right? But adjusting legislation, adjusting taxes is that a very significant, a comprehensive analysis of what the impacts are needs to be undertaken. And it does feel that some of these policies that have been introduced over the course of the last 4 years haven't been really tested. They haven't been thought through and every aspect of 360 degree analysis hasn't been conducted. And we're seeing that in the realities of and the challenges of the rental market, particularly at the moment.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go next probably. And that is, there's been a lot of ideas thrown around about fixing the rental crisis, but it's taken us how many years to get here? What do you think? I'm not going to say what's the solution, but I'm going to say, what do you think are some of the start points that the Victorian government and the federal government could be looking at to help alleviate some of these challenges?
The government needs to give the rental providers, the landlords, a win. A lot of this is sentiment too. It's not purely an economic decision for a lot of people. So if we look at the spread, you know, you referred to interest rates as a lever or a mechanism to bring down inflation, right? It hasn't proven effective. And the reason it hasn't proven effective is because Australia is broken up into three segments, really, from a housing perspective. Those who own their properties outright, those who have a mortgage, and those that rent, right? And it's about a third each. Now, that third that owns their property are also cash rich and are spending like money's going out of fashion, right? So the people that have mortgages have reduced their spending. And then if they're investment property owners and they've got a mortgage, they've passed on some of that cost to renters. So renters and mortgage holders are suffering, but those richest people within our society are spending money at a rate of knots, right? So inflation hasn't been curbed. Now, if you look at the rental market too, in the Victorian context, you've got those segments still, right? So there's those segments of the mum and dad investors, right, who have got a mortgage and they're hurting financially. You've got renters who are really hurting financially. And then you've got those investors that don't have a mortgage on their property and they're not hurting financially, but they're really sick and tired of the complexity of the legislation and the regulation that's been put on them, right? Now, say what you will about that segment and the privilege that they enjoy, but the reality is those people are exiting just as quickly as the people that sit with a mortgage who can't afford to keep their investment property. And we need to keep those people, every single one of them, within the system right now, because 80% of all rental properties are provided by private investors, right? So we lose one and it gets harder for renters. So giving any investor, landlord a win, we've made a number of proposals around land tax in particular. That's been the straw that's broken the camel's back. And the government needs to do something there, or they need to do something in terms of incentivizing investment more generally to bring more people into the marketplace, whether that's exemptions on stamp duty more broadly for investment properties, hypothetically, or more subsidies for meeting the minimum standards, which it's on the agenda that from an energy efficiency perspective, sometime next year or beyond, those minimum standards will increase again and there'll be very significant costs associated for landlords to meet those minimum standards.
Yeah, interesting. I'm loving talking to you at the moment because it feels like you've seen my questions and you're kind of leading into the next one and the next one and the next one. So I was actually going to ask you about your interest in the environment, sustainability, and you've just come back from COP29. So the environmental considerations for real estate agents, you've just mentioned them there too, or the real estate industry, I think have been on my radar since 2016. And I had been kind of hoping since about 2016 that we'd start showing people things like how to save energy in your property and what the ongoing running costs of property was and all that sort of thing. They're just a couple of my little hobby horses. But what environmental initiatives coming back from COP29 do you think that the industry should prioritise?
Well, I'm with you 100%. I think that we're laggards. That's all you can say about it as a sector in the real estate space, right? Now, that is unkind and unfair to a number of proponents of sustainability and advocates and people that are leading the charge within the sector. And there's a number of them that are doing incredible work. But as a whole, we've been really slow to jump on. You're talking about 2016, that's 8 years ago, right? And not entirely the rest of the world. And I think what's come out of COP29 is probably a demonstration that, again, there are people that are really resistant to these changes. But put aside the environmental and the social imperatives of improved sustainability, the economic imperative is so clear now, right? And I think staring down the barrel at us is a massive opportunity within the real estate space to be part of the change and to benefit and profit from the change. And that's the message that I'm trying to emphasize, because the economic and social may not resonate with everyone, right? But if there's a financial calculus in making these changes and being part of the transition, then we're more likely to have success. And that's what I was doing at COP, basically, is representing our sector, trying to build those relationships and build some clarity around the role that our sector needs to play in the transition to higher energy efficiency in the built environment. So when we talk about the built environment, that's just buildings. That's everything, right? And the biggest concern right now are the buildings that are already here, which are the buildings that everyone across our sector are dealing with on a daily basis, whether that's a house, an apartment, a commercial building, an industrial building, right? Where do people that are buying and selling these properties, we're managing them for the people that own them, and we have a pivotal role in helping the owners of those properties make decisions about what the sustainability, the energy efficiency of their property and the resilience of their property looks like, right? We are their advisors, and that's where we sit in this entire value chain. And it's kind of on our shoulders to help educate and help them make the decisions that are going to benefit them financially in the short term and the long term, and that are going to contribute to this targets of achieving net zero.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I was sort of working with an environmental guy back in 2013. We were working together at PwC on an initiative about when they were talking about carbon taxes and so on, which was about the time that my circa 2000 fridge broke down. And, you know, it was funny because I couldn't afford to buy a new fridge. And this was one of those old double door things that you could almost roll on the side and invade a small country in if you wanted to. And I was really reluctant to let it go, but it had no doubt died. But then I eventually replaced it with something, and I didn't realize how much power this old thing was actually chewing up. And so the new fridge had actually paid for itself in my electricity bill within about 3 months.
Exactly. And you can see those decision trees, right, where you've got the choice, you know, is it a heat pump or is it a traditional gas hot water service, right? The heat pump's going to cost you slightly more, but you're going to start enjoying the benefits of that immediately. There's heaps of health benefits in making these decisions as well. They say that something like 15% of all childhood asthma is attributable to household gas appliances. And the health outcomes in a energy efficient home as opposed to a traditional home, then it's measurable. There's just unarguable amounts of data that demonstrate that you enjoy a better quality of life, you're healthier, you sleep better, you feel better just because you're making these decisions that are making a healthier environment for you to occupy.
I feel like there might be a GPT for that at some point in the future, but just for those calculations.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of tech in this space already that's either in beta testing or coming out that can rate entire suburbs and the energy efficiencies of housing at scale. And what we need to be cognitive of as a sector too is put aside even the opportunity and think about the risk, right? And what's going to come from a legislative and regulatory perspective is that we're going to have to start reporting our emissions as businesses, right? Scope 1, 2, and 3. And the scope 3 are your downstream emissions. So things like the emissions that your suppliers use. So your suppliers are going to have to start reporting as well. And you're going to have a score, right? And what that score looks like will impact on the cost of insurances, the cost of services. If you've got finance from a bank, all of these things are going to be interconnected, right? So being ahead of the curve and being in front of these and changing now will mean that you save money, that you won't have any interruption or any impact on the services that you're delivering in your organization. And similarly, banks are going to have to start, they have to now rate their entire mortgage portfolio, right? They have to rate the risk that sits within those portfolios. Now, if they're going to go through and look, all right, you're an 8-star and you're a 4-star and you're a 3-star and you're a 2-star, and they're going to have to contemplate whether or not they cut out those lower rated houses out of the portfolio, because if the whole score of the portfolio comes down, it's going to cost them way more to insure, to maintain, or do they provide finance to bring those properties up to spec at a much lower rate? So there's an enormous amount happening from a technological and regulatory perspective.
Yeah, so that's fascinating stuff. So what you're saying is that it is possible in the future that if a property is not up to snuff as in terms of its energy efficiency, then the banks might not lend against that as an asset, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You can't remember the massive financial crisis in 2008 where all the CDCs, where they put those mortgages together and they had all them rated differently. It's the same kind of concept, right? But they're not going to be able to put high risk, low energy efficiency properties into their portfolio unless it's at a much higher rate or something like that, right? So it's like a high risk lender. They're not going to lend to a high risk person unless it's at a much higher rate, you know, to protect themselves. Same deal will apply to properties.
Yeah, fascinating. I could talk about that all day, but let's move on. I'm interested in your PhD research, actually. So can you share a bit about your research on the cyber attack term and its relevance to, well, its relevance to your work in real estate?
I'll struggle to tie it to real estate. I won't give you the full title of the PhD because it is mind-numbingly long and boring, but it's ostensibly it's a genealogical analysis of the term cyber attack as used by political, business, and military leaders, right? So essentially, I want to trace how that term has been used since its first usage by military, business, and political leaders, and then analyze the context in which they've used it and what the actual attack was. Now, the rationale behind this is to try and find an end point where these are the actual events that are being termed attack, a cyber attack explicitly. And the reason you try and do that is because from there you need to extrapolate a clearer definition of these different sub things like a DDoS or whatever the case may be, right? Malware. Because in the international context, international law, right? You can't prosecute, you can't build laws around a really generalized term. It's a catch-all at the moment. People use it to describe anything from a kinetic event in real world. Like if we think about what the Olympic Games, people have probably not heard of it, but it was the attack by Israel and the US on Iran's nuclear facilities in Natanz, right? It's called a cyber attack. But then, you know, the different leaders will apply that term to a hack on Medicare or something like that too. So in order to actually build enforceable laws and then extrapolate from laws, what are the responses to cyber attacks or these different attack types? You need to start with a definition. So it's confusing, but it's a step down the line towards crafting enforceable, explicit and clear international laws around responses to, say, cyber attacks, these different classes of digital incursions.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what got you interested into that particular use of the language, because for me, I sort of think we use these war words so much in the real estate industry, like attack the competition and we're going to smash it today. I mean, it's probably not related, but we do use these words a lot without even thinking about them. And yeah, I'm just interested to know what took you down that path.
That's a really good point. You know, language is powerful, right? And the liberal usage definitionally of words, and language is always evolving, don't get me wrong, right? Like, you know, what something meant when you and I were teenagers is potentially radically different. Like literal. Literal does not mean literal anymore as we understood it 20 years ago. But it's really important that the meaning of the words that are being said is clear and that it's understood by those people using it too. I think you're bang on there too. And is there danger in the usage of words with violent connotations? Is that subconsciously communicating something that isn't really helpful, that isn't in line with what like our values or our ethics might be? But how did I get here? Back in 2018, I went to Harvard to do a master's in international relations. And my focus was on national security. At the time, I was like, oh, maybe I'll transition out of real estate into national security. So I focused very much in that world in terms of intelligence analysis, the structures of the intelligence organizations and how they operate in an international context, particularly the US institutions around that. And I probably did about four subjects that were technology and cyber related. And coming out of that, I could see that there was a gap there in the literature. And it's always hard when you're trying to come up with a PhD topic, like the idea is for it to be novel, that it hasn't been done before and that it can add some value to the overall space sector or area that you're writing on. So I saw a gap there and I'd seen it just repeat, bling, 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 this kind of confusion around how do we respond to these things? How do we qualify what they are? What's proportionate for responding to a Medicare hack as opposed to a kinetic event, you know, where actual physical things in the real world have blown up as a result of a cyber incursion? You know, how do we get to a point where we can say just like they did with nuclear weapons and whatnot, like you actually have to get to a point where you go, like, these are the red lines and these are what we will do. If you do X, we will do Y. And we're so not there in terms of the cyberspace question of cybercrime, you know, whether that's financial or whether that's interstate.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating space and I can see why the interest. But you just mentioned ethics and that's where we're going next. And let's go back to real estate. Actually, before we do, I sort of think even if you can't draw that back to real estate, I think everything happens for a reason. And maybe, you know, maybe the reasons aren't clear, but the future could hold anything. But anyway, ethics. Let's talk about ethics and real estate, everyone's favorite topic. I've noticed that there's a couple of things that you're quite passionate about, underquoting still on the radar and having registered bidders in Victoria. Tell me what's driving that and where you're up to.
So registered bidders, just like from an REIV perspective, and I'll make the distinction, I'll take my REIV hat off and talk as me and then in my capacity as the president of the REIV. The REIV made a call to get behind a bidder registration because what's coming down the line with AML, so the anti-money laundering requirements, we're going to have that information anyway, right? So let's be on the front foot again. Like in the climate space and the energy efficiency space, let's lead rather than lag. So we definitely want to see these changes come in. I know a lot of people in Victoria, Melbourne's the auction capital of the world. We do anywhere between 30,000, 40,000 auctions a year. And people are very passionate about it as an art form, really, and as a component, you know, an identifying factor of the industry in Melbourne and more broadly Victoria. But we're also constantly pursuing a greater professionalism, higher standards, right? And a lot of people in the sector see that, as minor as it is, really, just to know who's coming to an auction, who is intending on bidding, who's got the financial capacity to bid and bid legitimately, and that they can be identified. That's not too much to ask, but it's a means of, again, sort of incrementally stepping up the process, the system, the professionalism of the space. I know some people make the argument that would preclude someone from arriving and bidding on a Saturday morning after seeing a property for the first time. And I'd push back against that and say, we've been using for years now technology that could identify someone immediately. And that with those AML regulations that are coming, we're going to have to be able to do that on the spot, is to identify and register someone. And those instances were the unicorn instance where someone comes and bids $5 million on the Saturday morning, the first time they've walked through the property, will continue to happen, you know, in the anecdotal way that they do right now.
Yeah, I thought that was just on the block. I just give them
that's the thorn in our sector side. To my mind, it is the number one reason that we are distrusted. The number one reason that the general public rate us so poorly when it comes to ethics, right? And that's because it's so clearly, when utilized, an act of deception. And I would also argue to those people that used it and that are proponents of it, and I've been arguing this for more than 8 years, there is no competitive advantage to it. There is absolutely no competitive advantage to it. And the practice of auctions on a weekly basis for as long as Melbourne's been doing them demonstrates that. You ask any auctioneer, when does the real bidding start? When does the action start at an auction? It's when they call the property on the market, right? So why not start at that point? Or why not be really clear that you're starting that range that is required in under Victorian law around the quote price? If it's unarguable, if it's clear, if it's always there, you're going to have the right bidders there who are willing to purchase to pay at or above that reserve price. That's been the case as long as auctions have run, that system has proven effective. So I'd push back against the notion that underquoting is an effective tactic other than to frustrate a lot of buyers and create a low level of trust and a low level of ethical standing for our industry.
Do you think there's a chance, and I mean, let's just play this one out here, is that as AI gets better and more consumers are using AI to work out themselves what a property is worth, that the whole underquoting process might become a moot point? You think that it'll get good?
Yeah, I think so. The one variable that, again, you know this better than me, but like you, I'm keenly watching what's happening here, and I have enormous faith in what AI can do to enhance everything that we do within the sector. I'm extremely confident that things will change very dramatically over the coming years. The one variable that I'm not confident that AI will be able to capture is the human emotion, right? I have seen thousands of other auctioneers across the country will have seen the most irrational, illogical decisions made in the context of an auction by people because of some variable in their emotions, whether or not it's just a pure passion for the property where it's competition. You know, up at Elite Retreat, I had to stand here like this during the auctions with my hands under my armpits because I bid so competitively, I just would have spent everything that I had to win those auctions. You get me in an auction environment and I'll just go crazy on the bidding. And people respond really emotionally. So I don't know about that, but I do see a world in which from a pricing perspective, from a quote perspective, the volume of data and the precision with which that data can be condensed into something immediately digestible and probably really true to the current context, I think we'll stop offering valuations as people. And look, a lot of my sales guys say that anyway. They say, we don't value properties, we sell properties. That's what we do. It's not like it's irrelevant what we think because we don't determine the market. The market determines the market. And if AI has enough data points and is sophisticated enough to say, well, this is where the market's going to land, and we start seeing that over and over again. Like you said, I was just in COP and I went to a Google session, right, on things that they're doing, right? Weather prediction, travel patterns, fuel efficient routes, right? They predict the weather better than anything in that, like they are 97% accurate with weather right now, something that's never been able to do, right? And they're showing, they're predicting the paths of cyclones a week and a half before the next best prediction modules are predicting them. And they're 10 times more accurate. They're like pinpoint precision predicting what path the cyclone will take like 2 weeks out. So I think it's inevitable.
Yes, such an interesting space as well, how AI might change the industry. And, you know, I keep saying to everyone, our imaginations probably aren't big enough to see what's coming, but it's interesting to sort of play out these possible scenarios, I guess.
Absolutely. Oh, look, I think we've, you know, you're a pioneer, you're a champion, you're on the front, you're trying to drag us along with you, which I celebrate and applaud. We need to stick with you and we need to be ahead of the curve as a sector because if not, we're done. We will be left behind. There will be a few people that capture that change that are on the front end of that change. And if you're not one of them, what your role looks like today will bear very little resemblance to what it looks like in 3 or 4 years, 5 years even.
Yes, it's definitely a changing space. You know, we've talked about so much change today, and I've got to say, it's amazing to talk to someone who is quite future focused. So I'm going to ask you a couple of tricky questions now. Let's just say you're starting all over again in the real estate industry, but somehow you know what you know now, as in the knowledge that you've gained from going to COP20, all of the education that you have, your time at the REIV, your brain must actually be so big. Like that, that's ridiculous. But knowing all of that stuff, what are the things that you would focus on right now to make sure that you had the best career path possible in the industry?
That's a great question. I really think AI, a business founded on absolute integration of AI into every component, is critical. If you were capable of stitching them together or integrating them into your entire workflow, whether that's from a property management perspective, from a sales perspective, from an administrative perspective, that you could really get away with doing the work of 5 to 10 people in a traditional context with just one person sort of overseeing and being that human person in the loop, I would integrate that full transparency I really worry that property management is on the verge of not needing a human in it, right? There are platforms right now that are only a hair's breadth away from being able to essentially remove people from the equation. And that, I get poo-pooed a lot when I say that to people. They always say, no, no, there's always going to be a human element. They, you know, people want to deal with humans. And I push back against that and say, no, people don't want to push, you know, I don't buy anything in shops anymore. Any experience that I can have where I don't have to speak to a human, as long as I'm getting the result I want, then that works for me. And I think overwhelmingly people are moving into that camp where they just want the efficiency of being able to find out what they want, buy what they need, get the service that they need without needing to interact with a human. And I think that the door is being knocked on from a property management perspective. So I personally wouldn't hire a property manager. I'd use technology right now because I don't think that they will be as essential down the track. So if I was starting day dot and wanting to build up a property management business, that's what I'd do. In terms of energy efficiency too, I'd be implementing for both sales properties and property management. I would have used one of the services that are out there and readily available now to get a rating on the energy efficiency of the property and be having those conversations with investors and sales clients, vendors, about making the upgrades of those properties because they will translate into higher rents on the property management side and they'll translate onto higher sale prices on the selling side as well. Ethically, how do you differentiate yourself? I think that's where the human component is still really critical. So if your company values are around sustainability, if they were around best practice, and then you really built in an ethical standard or charter into your business and that was advertised out there and you became social ethical, like you had an actual ESG policy and you advertised as a point of difference, there'd be an opportunity there. And if I was starting today and I was 20 years younger, I would advertise every property with a reserve price that was for sale.
Yeah, it's an amazing answer there. But I think that was where I was trying to get to a point where we kind of tied all these threads together because you've talked about so many potential differentiators today, which has been great. And like I sit on both sides of the fence, one is trainer and the other is consumer of the real estate industry. And as you know, as a consumer, it's very hard to tell the difference. But I think what you've inadvertently given everyone is a bit of a masterclass in differentiation in how to position yourself ahead of other real estate agents for the future. So thank you.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So in wrapping up, we're getting very close to the fat man coming down the chimney and spreading cheer and all sorts of things. Actually, it looks like Santa's already sort of hit your place with the Lego there. But if I could ask you, if you could give Santa one wish and he could grant anything for the real estate industry, what would the number one priority on the man with the red jacket be?
Look, I started somewhere here when I spoke about getting into the industry. There are so many incredible people. You're one of them, but there are so many overwhelmingly great people in this industry who don't enjoy the respect that they deserve, right? Because they contribute so much to their communities and they contribute so much to the fabric of our societies around the country. And I would love for us to be able to, as an industry and as a sector, we don't need to be celebrated, but not regarded with contempt, which is sometimes the case. Just a modicum more respect for the really valuable work that people do across Australia in this space, you know, because when it comes down to it, what do we do is we help people get into homes. Yeah. We help people find a place to start their business or to run their business. We're about helping people to realize their dreams. And that sounds really corny, but it's the truth of the matter. And the overwhelming majority of people out there doing what we do day to day, do it from a place of wanting to help, not wanting to take advantage of people.
Yeah, it's a great wish. And I agree with what you said right at the top of the show, which is there are so many hardworking, really good people in the real estate industry that they deserve to be celebrated and not thought of some people think of real estate agents in general. So great, Joe Rich. Well, I was going to ask you to sing us out, but that's proud and I managed to get Bianca Denham to sing us out last year, but...
I've got a cold. I'm putting it to a tear.
Maybe next elite retreat. But Jacob, I wanted to thank you so much for coming in and sharing your wisdom and your knowledge and what you've been up to. And the REIV is certainly lucky to have you. If there was one thing that you'd like to leave everyone with, what would it be?
Have a happy and a safe Christmas ahead. Keep your friends and your family close. Give them a hug, love them, and enjoy hopefully some time off with them to recharge the batteries into 2025. Have a great year in 2025 ahead.
Amazing. Jacob Kane, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Elevate Podcast with thanks to Connect Now. To stay in touch with all things Elite Agent, sign up for our daily newsletter, The Brief, at eliteagent.com/subscribe.